Jim Renson writes in his chapter titled To Help or Hinder, as the Civil War raged around him in early 1863, Private Willard J. Whitney received some bad news from home. He was encamped with his 57th Pennsylvania Infantry in Virginia when word arrived that his uncle, Alvinza Gardner, had passed away back in West Abington. The rugged farmer had raised Whitney from boyhood after his parents died, so the news hit hard. The young soldier took time to pen a passionate tribute and mail it off to the Wyoming Republican newspaper in Tunkhannock. The community, Whitney wrote, had just lost its best citizen, a faithful Baptist and a temperance pioneer, the first to raise a barn without liquor in his neighborhood. But it was his uncle's abolitionist work from the late 1830s onward that drew the utmost praise. He was also the first to establish a depot on the Underground Railroad where the poor, downtrodden black fleeing from oppression could always find an open purse, a good meal, clothes if needed, and a helping hand to bid him Godspeed on his way to the land of freedom, which he failed to find under the stripes of our free, for whites, country. His conscientiousness was very large, and his hatred of wrongdoing intense. Words of Private Whitney. Uncle Alvinza, the private proclaimed, was a shining example of the positively good man, one who devotes his whole energies to elevate the moral, physical, and religious states of the community in which he lives. The negatively good man, by contrast, is a quiet, inoffensive sort of person who lacks force of character enough to make an enemy, one who never crosses the path of evildoers by bringing them to grief, one whom everybody calls a good old soul, who is hardly known outside of his own immediate circle of friends, and whom no others miss when he dies. If being a positively good person meant following Alvinza Gardner's example, then every white inhabitant of Greater Abington had a choice to make. Would he or she, like Gardner, become a friend of the fugitive slave, or merely a negatively good person who demurs from fighting wrong? In the late 1830s and early 1940s, when circumstances were forcing that choice on people, one could find abundant reason to demur. The disenfranchisement events of 1837-38 made clear that abolitionism and black advocacy were hostile acts in the eyes of Pennsylvania authorities and most of the state's electorate. Underground Railroad work ran afoul of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1793, still on the books, with a steep $500 fine for aiding runaways. It could even risk physical harm. Anti-abolitionist riots had swept across New York City in July 1834. A racist mob in Philadelphia had torched Pennsylvania Hall, an abolitionist site, in May 1838. The financial panic of 1837 fed into the malice toward black people by causing many working-class whites to fear that blacks would steal jobs and depress wages. An informed citizen of Abington would have known all that. Closer to home, he probably would have heard how hooligans violently prevented Wilkes-Barre abolitionist William Gildersleeve from hosting anti-slavery lecturers in 1837 and again in 1839, tossing a pail of black dye on Gildersleeve in one incident, and were never punished. A person might recall what had happened up in Montrose in 1835 when the call to form an anti-slavery society drew 86 signatories, but also 143 foes who publicly denounced the dangerous principles and projects of the abolitionists. In Carbondale, a meeting in 1837 to form an anti-slavery society was taken over by foes claiming to represent 9/10 of the town and who declared abolitionists to be enemies of the Union of the States. A few anti-slavery branches did form up in neighboring Susquehanna County as well as in Bradford County, but the do-gooders predictably ran into angry opposition. In his new book, Jim Remsen takes us to the heart of his hometown, heart in many senses, Waverly, Pennsylvania, and he writes, "The Waverly Whites might have heard the testimony of Ignatius Thomas from Maryland. Thomas had a twin brother, Joshua. They were twice sold as a pair and always worked together in slavery. Ignatius couldn't persuade his frightened brother to run away with him. They never would see one another again." Exposure to powerful slave testimonies, along with the whites' innate piety, their proximity to the freedom roots, and the kinship networks they could summon, were four elements that laid the groundwork for Greater Abington's fledgling Underground Railroad. They also enabled Waverly to move beyond serving as a way station to becoming a permanent home for fugitives, as villagers soon embarked on an even more radical experiment in self-integration. The vanguard knew everyone wouldn't join their civil disobedience. There was always a proportion of white residents who saw slavery and the subjugation of blacks as no concern of theirs. So long as those bystanders let the support work go on unimpeded as negatively good people, the activists knew that was enough, at least for the moment. Jim Remsen helps us to feel that tension, to experience the person-by-person reckoning. In his new book, Embattled Freedom, Chronicle of a Fugitive Slave Haven in the Wary North, just published by Sunbury Press in Mechanicsburg, Jim Remsen has made his career as a journalist, retiring as religion editor at the Philadelphia Inquirer. He is the author of three books, The Intermarriage Handbook, Visions of Tioga, and just now, Embattled Freedom. Appropriately, the Waverly Community House is hosting the official book launch for Embattled Freedom this Sunday afternoon with a signing and talk at 1 o'clock. There will be another author event on St. Patrick's Day at the Library Express at the Marketplace at Steamtown in Scranton. Jim Remsen paid a visit to the WVIA studios to tell us more about this story and his ties to the region.
I was a boy, a baby boomer boy in Waverly, a great little town to grow up in. I was running around in the woods and the fields, playing guns as a boy, as we used to call it back then. Loved history. My dad did as well, so I think I kind of got it through him. Was a boy when the Civil War was just being observed in its centennial. I was born in 49, so I would have been really 11, 12, 13, and just drank it up. Loved it all. But we also knew that on the edge of Waverly, there had been this little black settlement. I remember literally riding our bikes along the edge and seeing these little humble homes along the side of the road. People saying that's where the colored people live, which is how people would, you know, describe it back then. And didn't know much about it beyond that they were there and they were brought up and stayed because of this thing called the Underground Railroad, this very secretive network. But it was never taught. Not much detail ever, you know, came through. So really, I only circled back to learn more about it decades later. I moved away from Waverly to go to college, settled down in Philadelphia, had my career down there as a journalist. Left that about a dozen years ago, went off, did some other things, but also decided I wanted to do some writing and exploring. A couple of years ago, wrote a book about Indian and settler history in Pennsylvania, another thing that literally I wished I had learned as a boy in school. That was done. That was fun. I enjoyed doing that. And then I thought, well, what next? And it came back to me right under my nose was this history about the Underground Railroad and the black settlement in my old hometown. So I decided to plunge in, you know, deciding really I wanted to write about underappreciated parts of our local history right here in northeastern Pennsylvania. And here was a good one, too. So there wasn't that much written about it. There were some things, and I was able to tap into them. Read over as much of that as I could and used that as sort of a springboard. There was a fellow who is dead now, but when he was a boy, could have been me back in the 1940s, he did some very good research, probably as a high school kid, talking to some of the old timers, getting their recollections and some good detail there. So I definitely utilized that, but then built on that and would go to the local histories, you know, the old histories that were written, go to the old land records, some of the old archives, the old newspapers. One thing that jumped out at me as I did this was about the fact that Waverly had this fugitive slave settlement, and that when the Civil War came, 13 of the male residents of this black settlement enlisted when finally the Union Army accepted black soldiers in the middle of the war. And they enlisted, voluntarily went back down south to fight. And I thought, wow, how dramatic is that? And they were just mentioned in a sentence in some of these histories. So I decided I wanted to learn as much as I could about them, really chronicle them. And the book that emerged from my several years of research really uses their lifespans as the framework of the book. So you learn about what happened in the North for black people, primarily in northeastern Pennsylvania, from the 1830s until about the 1920s, which is when the first one of them was born and the last one of them, them being the dozen soldiers, died. So I decided to look at where they came from, where they originated in the South, if they were fugitives, but then what kind of reception did they get in the North? So not only did they come here and settle, but what was the political and social climate like for them here in northeastern Pennsylvania from the 1830s onward? And it was very dramatic, remarkable, turbulent times. A lot of the conflicts that were dividing the whole country were right here in northeastern Pennsylvania. By no means were we on the sidelines at all. And that was exciting to learn, also troubling in a lot of ways, too, to see a lot of the animosity toward black people was writ large, and not only coming from people on the fringe, but coming from elected officials who were elected and reelected, not just despite what they said, but perhaps because of what they said, by judges as well, by the establishment, by the ruling establishment of northeastern Pennsylvania. So you have this conflict that runs all the way through the story of the reformers, the abolitionists, the people championing black people, and black people themselves fighting for their rights, and the folks who are digging in their heels against it and fighting it tooth and nail all the way along. And I think it's important that we know it. We know how it's in our bedrock of the culture here. So it has this troubling aspect, but also this inspiring aspect to look at the champions who, you know, went as dissidents and went against the norm, in some cases were breaking the law. They were doing civil disobedience. And in a way, you can think of Waverly as a sanctuary city. They were breaking the law by allowing fugitives to settle there, and not only to harbor them, but to support them. And, you know, these champions were giving them jobs, giving them land, educating their kids. That was happening at the same time that their neighbors, literally the white neighbors of these white champions, were often on the other side of the fence. And somehow managing to stay together as a community and finding some kind of accommodation with each other. In fact, I read about one of the main abolitionists and one of the main, on the other end, they were Democrats back then, that was the Jacksonian Democrats, were business partners while also being polar opposites politically at the same time in Waverly. It was remarkable.
What was the basis of the Waverly settlement? Was there an agricultural base to the foundation of Waverly as a community?
Yes, right. It was very agrarian back then. People generally would be farmers, but Waverly emerged as the religious center. It's where the First Baptist Church was formed, and it became really a mother church for a lot of other Baptist churches that, you know, settled and were formed over the years. But it was the foundational center for the church, and also then for some supply stores and a roadside inn. So, you know, it became a population center, only a few hundred people, but back then that was, you know, significant size. A lot of the towns then were fairly autonomous too. They would be separated from, you know, other towns. They would be often ruling themselves. You know, that probably was a reason that if they had enough people willing to set up the fugitives, they were kind of left alone because the population was thin back then. But yeah, that was Waverly. A lot of the original settlers came from New England, came from Connecticut, eastern Connecticut, western Rhode Island, along the border there, and came over often as family networks. They would come and settle as family groups. And some of them were some of the most fervent abolitionists, too.
In the book, there's a sequence that is almost cinematic. I can see it in a movie, Jim. And that's the arrival of George Keyes when he gets to Waverly.
Yeah. somewhere in the early 1840s, and George Keyes is the man who's probably the founding father, you might say, of Waverly's Black Settlement. He was a fugitive, came from southern Maryland. I was able to go to where he had originated, down almost to the Potomac River in what's called Charles County. And he had a slave family. His owner sold off his slave wife and his slave children to a planter in the Carolinas. Never got to see them again, never got to say goodbye, they were gone. He was able to slip north, George, went up through Harrisburg. A common way up would be up along the river, and they would either come up on boats or they would come maybe into the water and out of the water, you know, keep the dogs off, maybe be helped along in a wagon, hidden inside a wagon. People have to understand, most of the fugitives who came north came alone, and they didn't come on anything like an underground railroad. There was an underground railroad, but it was very hit or miss whether you would run into it, and it wasn't a steady stop by, you know, hopscotching your way all the way to Canada. It would be fitful and intermittent, and a lot of them who came north would come just following their noses and not be helped at all. And often the folks who were helping them were other black people. The black community was really, you know, the comfort zone was one thing, but also they had skin in the game, they had the stake, they were in it to the end. There would be whites who helped them here and there as well, but the everyday helper would most likely be another black person if you were being helped along the way. But George came up, made his way, stopped in Wilkes-Barre, had a woman there who he was interested in, a free black woman named Hannah Fields, but must have been chased. So he had people on his tail, went up to the home of one of the leading abolitionists back there, a man named Rodman Sisson, who later moved to Waverly. At the time of this original episode, this was in La Plume. If folks know La Plume, you know, up 611 on the way up to Keystone College, Factoryville, on a hillside off to the right as you're heading north. I think the farmhouse is still there from what I can tell from the old maps. He made his way there, and Sisson yanked him into the house, get him out of danger, because he was being hunted, and told him to go upstairs to the upstairs bedroom and climb up into the chimney, up into the hearth, and clamber up there, and somehow there must have been a ledge or a way he could get a toehold and hoist himself up and suspend himself out of sight while Sisson kept the slave hunters at bay down below. And it apparently worked. There must have been some grumbling and shouting, but he wouldn't let him in the house, so they never even made it up to the bedroom. But that's where George hid until the slave hunters grumbled and went off, stalked away. And George, after a time, came back down again, and they safeguarded him, slipped him away from the house, kept him nearby, and then shuttled him over to Waverly, which is about 2 miles away. And George stayed, and the conditions were good. And he had been helped by Sisson's daughter, who was newly married over there to a man who owned some property, who in time would divvy up and make some of that property available to the early fugitives. So Waverly had a mix of fugitives, and I've been able to profile a few of them and understand, you know, what drove them. Waverly had a Baptist church. It had a Methodist church. Methodists were heavily involved in this, and it had a Presbyterian church. Presbyterians were heavily involved in it. I didn't even know Waverly had a Presbyterian church. It's long gone now. But the man who I identified as the driver of the Underground Railroad network out of the Abingtons and out of Waverly was Presbyterian. So the Presbyterians, like a lot of the denominations, were divided on the issue of slavery back then. There was something called the Old School Presbyterians, and they were not interested in fighting for abolition and for, you know, black people's rights. And then there was the New School, and they were all about abolitionism and immediate abolition, not just gradual. Even the abolitionist movement broke down into immediatists and the gradualists. The gradualists would say, well, we'll try to buy their freedom one by one, send them back to Africa. We don't really want them among us, but they shouldn't be enslaved. Where the immediate said, no, they must, by law, by force, immediate, this is a stain on our culture, we must rid society of it immediately. So Waverly was on the border physically between the old school and the new school. The old school Presbyterians were based in Kingston, right outside Wilkes-Barre. And the New Schoolers were based in Montrose, which was a real hub of abolitionism back then. And so Waverly was fought over and decided, basically through this leading figure in Waverly named Leonard Batchelor, to go with the Montrose New Schoolers and became outspoken on the issue of abolition. So that was happening, you know, in pitched fighting, almost home by home, village by village, what to do. So Waverly had a critical mass of abolitionists, and Batchelor was one of the leading ones. It was others who were Methodists and others who were Baptists as well. People had to decide one by one where they stood on slavery, and were they willing to hold up the idea of the national union as so precious that you would even make a compromise that would allow human bondage, or whether you would say, no, we cannot stand for that. Our salvation as a country and individually is at risk. So 1860 and 61 comes, the war breaks out. I'm talking about the one side, the ones who were anti-Lincoln, you know, who were known as Copperheads when the war began in the North. There were plenty of them in the county here. This was all of Lackawanna and Luzerne were one county back then. So, you know, be aware, the book, a lot of it is about Luzerne County, but it really was Lackawanna County would have been called Northern Luzerne back then. There were plenty of Copperheads there. There also were what were called Loyalists, people who were with Lincoln and were with, we have to put down this horrible rebellion by force. Even the Democrats, who were the more conservative of the parties and more accommodating of the South, they split into a camp that was willing to go to war, to we have to put this rebellion down, and others who were saying, no, we have to accommodate the South, let them keep their slaves, anything just to keep the country together. So there became great fighting internally over that. It was actually called Pennsylvania's Inner Civil War, which side to come down on. I have a quote in here, also a quote from in Scranton, right after Fort Sumter, which began the Civil War, 1861, and the country was electrified by this. In Scranton at the First Presbyterian Church, again, the Presbyterian. So here was a New School, you know, abolition-minded pastor who, as I say, minced no words in his sermon right again after the war broke out. The South had opened fire on the federal Fort Sumter. He says, and this is the way people wrote and spoke back then. It was wonderful to read some of this oration of the day. Oh, thou God of nations, he said, thou hast seen that the accursed minions of slavery have dared to fire upon the sacred flag of this country which thou hast created, this great free republic which thou hast ordained to be the asylum of the oppressed of all nations. They are seeking and threatening to destroy through their hellish ambitions to propagate and perpetuate the damnable institution of slavery. They would destroy the best government that thou hast given to man. We pray thee, stay their wicked hands already imbued with the blood of freedom, and curse them, we pray thee, O Lord, curse them, send them to the hell to which they belong, and save, O save, our beloved country. Wow. The public was deciding, sorting itself out, whether they were going to be loyalists, and there were plenty of loyalists. Waverly had them, Scranton had them, the northern townships had them, Wilkes-Barre had them. But also there were those digging in their heels and resenting the war, seeing it as started by the abolitionists, you know, this damnable war that has been forced on us. So I have plenty of that in the book about protests that were happening. There actually were draft riots around here. New York had a famous draft riot, but there was a draft riot in Blakely, protests in Carbondale. There were protests in, you know, the coal patch towns all the way through the war. It was a terrible time. But then come 1863, if I may jump forward to the middle of the war, that is when there was a need for reinforcements. There was a rethinking of whether to allow blacks in uniform. At first, it was totally just ruled out as a crazy idea that blacks would be either cowardly or too undisciplined to be able to handle weapons, just a racist idea. But then come 1863, after Lincoln had issued the Emancipation Proclamation, there was a clause in there allowing for blacks to be in the military. And then there was a law, a bill introduced to have them be full soldiers, called the Black Soldiery Bill. that was hotly debated in Congress. And I have quotes in there from our congressman of this area of the day fighting bitterly against it, saying that we Anglo-Saxons can take care of ourselves and we can't count on blacks to be capable soldiers, just ruling them out a priori as inferior. Fortunately, he lost the vote. The Democrats lost the vote. There was quickly a move to allow black recruitment. That's where actually I have the cover of my book that has a very powerful recruitment poster of the day that I invite folks to go and look at, that shows this man almost like a Moses, a black Moses, urging folks to enlist. And there's an image of a black soldier actually freeing slaves from the plantations in the South, which happened. And then another side of the image shows what you might think of as the promised land of a black man in a rocking chair reading a newspaper, having put down his plow, and his children going to school in the background, which is a miracle and sort of an American dream for the black community. And so the Union was able to have 180,000 black men in uniform in the Civil War, an astonishingly high number. We certainly didn't learn that growing up. 5 out of every 6 came from the South. Pennsylvania had 8,000 of that 180,000. Waverly had 13 who went down and fought. And very stirring to me, the fact that they left their security, their own promised land of Waverly, where their kids were being educated and where they were given jobs and even had land and homes. And they gave that up and put themselves in danger back down in the lion's den and returned south. So I'm proud to have chronicled what they went through. 9 of them served in 2 particular regiments that I was able to trace the service records of those regiments. One of them was the 3rd, called the U.S. Colored Troops. That's what these regiments were called. The 3rd went down to Charleston, South Carolina, fought in the sand there, and was able to press against one of the rebel forts until the fort was abandoned. Several of the Waverly men were injured in the sand down there in shell fire. 6 of the others were in another regiment that made its name in bravery at Petersburg, the Battle of Petersburg, which is not far from Richmond in Virginia in 1864. And one of the most powerful parts of this book, I mean, a history book does not really have a climax. It just marches you through the events. But in my mind, if there's a climax, it is June 15th, 1864 at Petersburg. It's chapter 8 in the book that recounts what these 6 men of Waverly went through. 14 hours of battle on a single day from dawn until dusk. Several frontal assaults into the teeth of Confederate rifle and cannon fire. Many, many of them wounded and mangled for the rest of their lives. They were able to capture several cannon batteries and had their victories take place in the view of white soldiers who were astonished with their success, because they were really on probation, you might say, in the eyes of the country. How would they perform? You know, would they be brave? Would they be undisciplined? And they performed very heroically. So I was able to pull together some of the statements about them on this heroic day of June 15th. It was witnessed by battlefield correspondents from some of the newspapers. And here's just a quick quote about that afterwards. In the thickest of the fight and under the most trying circumstances, they never flinched. The old Army of the Potomac, so long prejudiced and so obstinately heretical on this subject of black soldiers, stand amazed as they look at the works, the cannons captured by the Negroes, and are now loud and unreserved in their praise. And it goes on like this. And it so happens on that very day, June 15th, was the same day that Congress finally equalized pay for black and white soldiers. The black soldiers were paid less until that point, and their pay was equalized. So one of their attacks was so renowned that there's a painting of it at West Point at the U.S. Military Museum. They have only a few images out of the Civil War and only one of black soldiers, and it is of this 22nd Regiment that included 6 men from Waverly among its number. 2 of those men later, on July 4th of that very year, a few weeks later, they were wounded while going out for water for their comrades. And they were shot, and the wounds were so serious they festered, and they ultimately died from their wounds. I was able to chronicle what they went through. I'm not holding up their valor as necessarily any greater than the white soldiers. Great, someone write about what the white soldiers have done, but this is history that has not been told. These were unsung men, and they came back home to no particular fanfare. They returned to their families. They often lived shortened, painful lives, you know, with lifelong injuries. I was able to go to the National Archives and get their service records and their pension paperwork about their lingering wounds.
Where are they buried, Jim?
Well, different places, but most of them are buried at Hickory Grove Cemetery, which is a lovely country cemetery on the edge of Waverly. I would urge people to go visit. They're on, along primarily one row. One of them is buried behind my old boyhood church, the Methodist Church, right on the Community House Square, because the Methodist Church was so open that they actually took two of the fugitives as members of the church back in the 1840s.
Tell us, Jim, how you settled on a title.
Yes, that's a great question. I wrestled with that for a while. I gave a talk a few years ago about this, and I called it Scars and Stripes. A little play on words, and that was my working title for a while, but I rejected that after a while. It's the title of one of the chapters, but it was a little too clever for its own good, I thought, and also didn't quite convey. The embattled freedom really refers to the whole scope of the book, and it looks at it very much from a black perspective of their vulnerable rights. I haven't talked that much just now about their continuing struggle for legal rights, for equal rights, certainly before the war, during the war, and after the war. You might say to today, but really we're talking to early 1900s, when it was a whole lot worse than now, and how it was always in jeopardy. They would have the support of one party for a while when it served that party right, and then they would turn away from them. There was always an undercurrent of opposition to them that never went away. You can read from, you know, the Scranton Defender newspaper accounts about how they were feeling very hemmed in. They literally did not have rights to own property wherever they chose to live. There was a lot of redlining, you know, a lot of housing discrimination. They were barred from the unions. So their rights were embattled. And, you know, the battle obviously conveys a little bit of the war battle, but it really has to do with the social struggles that they were undergoing. And it's good for, you know, the majority white population, I think, to understand that and, you know, live with that in just in reading this book. I think I'm inspired in a lot of my life by my dear grandmother, dear late grandmother, who was a school teacher and taught immigrants in New York City, you know, right off the boat. But she said to me, you know, you don't know a person till you walk a mile in their moccasins. And, you know, that's certainly what you can do by reading this book. So I invite you to do that with that spirit.
Jim Remsen, journalist and author, speaking with us about his new study titled Embattled Freedom, Chronicle of a Fugitive Slave Haven in the Wary North, issued this month by Sunbury Press. The Waverly Community House is hosting the official book launch this Sunday afternoon, March 5th, with a signing and talk by Jim Remsen at 1 o'clock, the Waverly Community House, 1115 North Abington Road in Waverly. There will be another event on March 17th at the Library Express at the Marketplace at Steamtown in Scranton at 7:30 p.m. Again, Jim Remsen on hand to sign books and to give a talk. For more information on the web, jimremsen.com, and Remsen is spelled R-E-M-S-E-N, jimremsen.com, and his new study is Embattled Freedom, and that is issued by Sunbury Press just February 7th of this year. And there will be an official book launch appropriately at the Waverly Community House this Sunday afternoon, March 5th, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, a signing and a talk. And the Waverly Community House is located at 1115 North Abington Road. And Jim Remsen will have another author event, and that's St. Patrick's Day, March 17th, at the Library Express. And that's at the Marketplace at Steamtown in Scranton at 7:30 p.m. That's Friday, March 17th. For more information on the web, jimremsen.com, jimremsen.com. www.waverlyfilmmusic.com.